From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. My guest, playwright, poet, and now director, Benedict Andrews. It was said in the introduction to his plays, somewhere in these apparently familiar dialogues lurks something surprising, unfamiliar, strange. His work seeps into our unconscious. He certainly did that with his first film as director and adaptation of the play Una. Benedict, thanks so much for being here.
Pleasure to be here, Elvis. Thanks for having me.
And just rereading that introduction to your plays and going over, reading Fresh Breath and reading this stuff, there is that sort of idea of sort of chamber psychological drama that exists in your work, these things that seem familiar, in fact. I mean, I'm just thinking about the way you use Polly Harvey's song at the very beginning in a much more ominous way than anybody could ever have expected. Actually, tell the audience what we're going to see, what they're going to see when they see Una.
Yeah, so Una is an adaptation of David Harrow's play Blackbird, which I staged at the Schaubühne Theater in Berlin in Germany in 2005, and it really got under my skin then. But I was looking as a theater director, I've wanted to make a film for a very long time, and I kind of used to joke with people, I don't want to do an adaptation of a play. It should have nothing to do with the theater. Cinema should be pure cinema and free from the theater. But I loved this play very much, and I was very curious about how it might undergo a kind of, I don't know, alchemical transformation from the closed room of the theater to become a piece of cinema. And I think there are two ways into that. In the play, it's two people in a room. It's a kind of great verbal boxing match. It's one of the great chamber plays so far of this century, a piece of very, very punchy writing.
When I read the play, it reminded me a little bit of Mamet.
Yeah, it has that punchy language, and the rhythm of the language is part of it. It's a taut, emotionally complex psychological drama where the two people kind of rip layers of truth off each other.
And also a shifting of the power dynamic between the two of them.
Constantly. And that's that boxing match aspect. And it happens with language. And rhythm's really important in that. Like, so when I staged the play, even though it was in German, I treated that as a kind of score. Not at all in the filmmaking process. I wanted to see how, in a way, silence might open up in the film.
And in fact, it's silent for the first 4 minutes.
Yeah, and even then, the words of the play from the play or the text from the play doesn't come until about 15, 20 minutes in. But I guess the two doors out of the closed room of the theater into the film were two things for that. One was the idea of the encounter. And yes, that's something very special in the theater where we're locked in the same room as the two of them. But I think that's a starting point for great cinema, is the shock of an encounter between two people. And then the other way was the question of time. Blackbird the play is a story about two people who see each other again for the first time in 15 years. And what happened to them 15 years ago has marked both of their lives and has remained kind of stored underneath them. Una, in particular, the young woman coming to meet Ray in his workplace, is charged with questions that only he can answer. And that made me curious about how the question of time might open up in cinema. Cinema seems to me the medium par excellence to investigate the human experience of time and memory. What Tarkovsky talks about as sculpting time, but literally the way that we carry inside us all sorts of screens of memory from every single instant of our life that can be triggered and open up again. And this encounter between the two of them rips open that border between the past and the present, and the past starts to interrupt the present. I was really curious how the cinema might be a place to explore that emotional experience of time.
I guess, having never seen the play stage, it feels more to me like both of them are fighting to establish their version of truth mm-hmm. in this. I mean, that's where the war comes from. Mm-hmm. And watching the movies, it's much more about to whom we're empathetic rather than sympathetic. Mm-hmm. I mean, so we don't really know which side to believe mm-hmm. for a long time, I should say. Is that what your fulcrum really for finding a way to make this different from the play?
I think I think that's the fundamental action of the play as well, but it's a different experience of it. In the theater, the audience sit on the other side of an invisible wall, breathing the same air as the two actors, and they are weighing up everything like a kind of jury, they're at every single moment weighing up truth. But it's from the utterances of the actors and the words that they speak to each other. So when they talk about the past in the play, you might have one long speech from her. This is what happened to me the night you left me. And he answers that whole torrent or tirade of her monologue. He gets to answer it and balance it. And that's up to us to see that on the screens of our imagination in the room of the theatre. So we're kind of like the jury in that, weighing up truth, sifting it, like kind of, judge and jury. I think you become a kind of visual detective in the cinema. You're unpacking every gesture, every sign that you see, and you're seeing everything. But at the same time, you're weighing up what is true. Maybe not what happened in quite the same way, because I think in the cinema, once you see the past and you see the young Una in the past and you see those scenes in the past, they feel real. They feel like that happened. Now, we can be contesting how much of those memories are reliable, but it's more like it's actually the story of how do we look back on those and weigh up their consequence. And I think the audience are deeply involved in that kind of sifting through truth. And our job as a team putting the film together was to keep that on a knife edge and keep the audience walking that tightrope even as they walk outside of the cinema. So if we solve the mystery for them, if we said, yeah, he's just doing it again, or she's just a victim, or various questions that people have, we would be, to me at least, betraying her emotional experience, where extreme emotions have become mixed up, where desire and guilt have become mixed up, and where abuse and love have become mixed up. And the whole film exists on this very painful, very tender border between those two emotions. And that's the uncomfortable space that the characters share that the audience are invited into. So when they're sifting that truth, I think in the cinema it really hurts, because we're right there in a very intimate way with them.
Well, obviously the one real advantage you have in movies is the close-up.
Mm-hmm.
And you get really close to Una played Rooney Mara. You get really close to that face, really, really close to that face. I mean, talk about what made you decide to do that, to use that as much as, because even though you get really close, we can say about 40% of the time, her expressions are masked. I mean, you can see her working her way through a trauma and how much she wants to expose herself.
On one hand, as a theatre director moving into cinema, a kind of god for me is Bergman, and he's a master of those close-ups and where the face becomes a landscape on the screen. And that was something I was very curious about, and that's something where, as a theatre director used to chasing down raw performances from actors, the idea that the camera could focus in on the quiver of someone's lip or the flicker of an eye and how the truth and emotion resides in that was very appealing. But there's another strategy going on. There are, as in the film too, sort of, you know, great wides and sort of strange push-ins, and architecture plays a very important role in the film, and the way that you watch things through windows or through other framings. That's very important too. So actually those close-ups, when they start to happen, they happen at a point when I directed the play, I realized kind of just after halfway through, the characters have got to burn through a lot of fuel. The first line of the play is a shock, but then they've got to burn through a lot of fuel to get to the point where they start to face each other and face the truth and get to the nitty-gritty. And I think that's the point probably where in the film the close-ups actually start. And interestingly, to get to the point of those close-ups, they've chased each other through a series of a labyrinthine space till they end up in these boxy little rooms where there's nowhere to hide, just each other. And that's when the camera kind of earns the right to then get in really close on them.
It's a treat when we're talking about the film Una with its director, Benedict Andrews. As we're talking about this, though, Benedict, I guess I find myself thinking about how, and I want to get to that architecture, about how when we see Ray, he's in these rooms, many of which have glass, big glass windows. He's basically hiding in plain sight. I mean, that's the decision you made to do this, that he's available in this way, but not because he's become someone else, or has he?
Mm-hmm.
And there is a character introduced here, played by Riz Ahmed, who we really get the chance to see or ask ourselves, is Ray capable of the truth in those relationships with that character before we get outside of his place of work? Now, that was interesting. You took us there rather than to his home. Talk about that decision. Take us into that place where there's people constantly going around and we get a chance to sort of judge him, if you pardon the expression, as an adult.
in a way, this is me honouring the source of the play, but trying to open out. The play takes place with two people in the lunchroom of a workplace. And I always, one line stuck with me when she said, what actually do you do? What do you actually do here? She said, this is, it's one of these places that you drive past on the highway, and it's a box by the side of the road, and all you see on the side of it is the temperature. And I found it quite interesting that this man who had been, he'd lost the community of men for the crime he did 15 years ago. He went to prison. He lost respect. He had smeared on his face in prison. He became a pariah. He lost the community of men. And he's fought his way back into that under a new identity and a new name. And as you say, he's hiding in plain sight. But it fascinated me that he chose to, you know, he has a group of guys that he looks after. He's a mid-level manager in that. But for me, I realized he didn't want to become an executive. He was happy to have got this back and to be at this level and to have his own controlled world there where he belonged again. But at the same time, he's hidden in this box. And on a conceptual level, that was very interesting to me, that their encounter is taking place within a series of boxes within boxes. And it gave birth to a very cinematic idea that comes from the Stanley Kubrick playbook, which is the idea of the labyrinth, and the idea of the labyrinth in the as a special cinematic place.
But also making the movie in its way circular. I mean, taking us back to a house with a little girl.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a Kubrickian kind of thing to do too.
Right.
I was thinking about a scene that really hit me as to being sort of a version of the combined romantic memories of the past is when they're at the pool. Mm-hmm. And they're underwater. Mm-hmm. And there's so much going on there because we see this flirtatious relationship and more than that, and these girls looking at them. Mm-hmm. I mean, that to me feels like the crux of the film to mm-hmm. me, because there's so many different points of view happening there, mm-hmm. them being lost in this world underwater, but again, still in plain sight, mm-hmm. that you chose to do this. So everything he's doing, he can be seen mm-hmm. doing, raises for me that question of more the degree of his delusion than hers.
I think you've hit on one of the cruxes of the film and the study of the relationship there, and a kind of nihilistic relationship, certainly a criminal one, and certainly one that caused immense damage to both their lives and to hers, to the people around them. But it's a relationship that, when she was young, could only be determined through code. We discover they had codes for how to meet, and they're always having to meet in secret. So they have this exclusive relationship. So we're talking about a relationship that has to, for criminal reasons, exist in a bubble. And love can do that. Love can make you feel like you're the only two people in the world, and so many great pop songs are about that, where it's us versus the world and we disappear into that bubble. So that crime is also mimicking love there, and that's why it starts to – it felt like love to her. It felt like romance for her enough that she was willing to leave her family and friends and run away. So when she finds him again 15 years later – actually, we explore a whole series of spaces where this same exclusive kind of relationship in a bubble is happening. Throughout the film, they're constantly running away into small rooms, but even...
There's only one sequence he literally is hiding from people.
Yeah, alone. Yeah. But at other times, they're having to be, even if other people are watching them through glass, they're having to, just the two of them. And another one for me is that moment when they're in the past, when they're in the Ferris wheel and it stops in the top. This is, again, a kind of... a metaphor for their relationship, like when they are underwater with the girls looking on. This is, for me, the story of a relationship where these two people excluded themselves from other people, and a love that's not taking place within the community. It has no future. He at least knows that. She believes in the idea of a future. They run away to Europe. They live in some sort of imagined future.
But he even says at the top of the merry-go-round, what if we could stay here forever?
What if we were stuck up here forever? Which was exactly that metaphor, because in a way they are in their memory. They are still stuck up there forever.
There's a lot to talk about. It's a terrific film. It's Una, its director, the combative Benedict Andrews, is sitting across from me. It's The Trip with Ismo. Come stay with us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm talking to first-time filmmaker, but not first-time director, and poet, and playwright, and musician, and probably park stars too, Benedict Andrew. His film is Una. There's so much going on here that, to me, is about an expanse of play can, I only can go by the evidence, really anecdotal of having read it and not having seen it staged, about how much of this he's admitted to himself, because so much is him, there's a sequence of him at the bar, which I don't want to give too much away about, and then the sequence when his coworker, played by Riz Ahmed, says, "You're not her dad," and the jolt on his face, it's almost this sensory trigger for him, this memory trigger. I mean, you found so many ways to sort of break this thing up into a bunch of component pieces rather than have that momentum of these dialogues. Mm-hmm. And for me, this goes back to that line I quoted from the foreword, the introduction to the plays. You know, these things that seem familiar aren't familiar. And this love to them seems like a familiar thing, but it's strange. Mm-hmm. and there's this thing that you can tell it's scarred them forever, but they love the idea, both of them, to some extent, this masochism. They love the idea of running their fingers across this scar, don't they?
She has to. She hasn't been able to heal those scars. I think he thought the door was shut, and the film leads us to speculate about his new life now, whether that kind of crime and exploitation continues or whether he's indeed a good man. All these things are kind of packed into each other, and that's sort of the powder keg of the film, and it's what both Ben Mendelsohn and Rooney Mara do in those two extraordinary performances, actually keep multiple possibilities alive. And that's something I wanted to do in the filmmaking, in those various things that you describe, and those flashes. I don't know if he knows in his sickness, if he's a kind of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He's lived by two names, Ray and Peter, and maybe he's buried that so far in himself and it's coming back. It's so much a question of identity. And I think this thing that you touch on where people become strangers to themselves has certainly been a theme in my, perhaps that's what poetry does. Perhaps poetry allows us to kind of reform the world and our experiences in it by what Brecht would have called a Verfremdungseffekt, by seeing the world strange again. It become we see it's the invisible, poetically, politically, all sorts of things. We start to see the hidden, whether they're hidden structures or whether they're hidden feelings. And I think that's something I pursued in the theatre. And I think the theatre is an interesting place to pursue that. I've been interested in characters who we follow to limits of human behaviour, and that they go through the fire in a way to have a kind of new knowledge on the other side of that. Blanche DuBois does that. King Lear does that. And I think this is kind of the great space of tragedy, for me at least, is by going through that, they become alien to themselves. They lose their comforts. King Lear, literally, he loses the role of king. He loses shelter. He loses family. All is ripped away till he's in the storm and the madness. And through becoming a stranger to himself and losing his certainty, something else opens up. And it's a terrible, painful space that Una lives in, where love and desire have become love and abuse have become mixed up. But there's something in that figure. Her world has become strange. She didn't follow the path that she thought she would. And I was curious how that was already before the abuse with him, that maybe that was already in her as a young woman. She was already looking for something else.
Talk to me about your conversations with Ben and with Rooney when you brought this material to them and what you wanted to do with it. Because, again, reading the play, there's evidence thrown back and forth and accusations, and that doesn't happen so much. I mean, there's visual information you offer this that in the flashbacks offers a romantic version of that. But in each case of those flashbacks, that romantic bubble is burst.
Yes, and in those flashbacks, I think in the cinema, and this was exciting for me as a theater director, there's a great opportunity to play with contrast and contradiction. So someone in language was describing something and we see something different. There's plenty of examples of that in the film, but especially when we never really show anything explicit in the past, but in the rooms, the two of them describe explicit things that happen between them, but maybe at that moment we see the camera floating in on some bushes, or maybe the camera's pushing in on Ben's face in a cracked mirror. So I was very excited about that other visual language would do to the kind of that emotional puzzle of the play. Rooney loved the play. She knew the play. So in my first conversations with her, she was deeply passionate about the play already. And Ben actually discovered it through the screenplay, or at least the draft of it that he first read, and that was also kind of exciting that he didn't have the baggage of the play. We talked a little bit about the beginning, how for me in the theatre the play is like a kind of score, and rhythmically like a score. I very deliberately did not want that here. So the actors, and Ben does this probably a bit more than Rooney, they had liberty to kind of change the text a little bit on the day, shift it around. They also had quite a lot of input, sometimes even on the day, into what the text would be. There was one instance with when he's telling her how he came back for her, where they had discovered some things that morning. We were due to shoot those scenes in the toilets. They'd reread some bits of David's play and discovered some stuff there. I was like, great, let's go spend some time where they're setting up the shots and improvise it a bit together, and then we added that in. So they were kind of collaborators in that as well. But I think the other thing about it really is that the film really transformed over the various stages of production. The script became something else as we shot it through that type of improvisation, and really reformed itself quite radically in the edit. And with a film that is so much about this borderline between past and present, we had a very good structure for that on the page, but it's kind of nothing like what it became once we were in the edit. We had to have the editor Nick Fenton and I had to have a very intuitive and experimental idea so that the puzzle of the past and the present would feel very vital and organic and chemical.
It's interesting. So much of the plays you seem to have done are about people basically in incredibly circumscribed circumstances, and certainly at Lenz's, if you're talking about Chekhov, that's almost all about that. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening here. I mean, mm-hmm. this thing that has maybe change them, but they can't see the future. I mean, so much of Chekhov is about not being able to see into the future at all. I mean, just
dreaming about it constantly, but not being able to see into it, talking about it nonstop.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's almost trying to conjure it,
well,
but
Chekhov
not being
is
able
about
to see
time
it.
For me, and Chekhov is about a kind of purgatorial time that these group of people of all different ages, he had a brilliant idea to break down the hierarchy of the stage, and that the 19-year-old actress playing Irina and her two older sisters sits beside the older actor playing Chaputikin, the doctor. And he brought communities of differing people together on stage and trapped them in as this echoing vessel of time and history.
But that thing too, where the hierarchical structures, there's this desire from the breakdown, but they never change. I mean, people wanting change desperately, but change is never going to happen.
In Chekhov, certainly, yeah.
Yeah, and for me, a big part of this is, given where we are now and this idea, not this idea, but this practice of predatory behavior, of the wanton exercise and callous exercise of power, and that has nothing to do with sexuality, but is an exercise of power, a kind of bullying. In the play, we saw these almost a dialectical proposition as much as it is a play. Here, it's, again, because there's so much silence, because Ben chooses to play it so intimately. I mean, only time he raises his voice is when he's hurt. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't really raise her voice at all. Mm. That there's that sense of intimacy. Mm. People may say, well, aren't you asking us to sympathize with predatory behavior?
It's very troubling, for sure. And it's troubling to become intimate with them. I think at each point, even when he's quiet, when you are still seeing a man who at each moment could be a brilliant liar manipulating her. So I think it still invites you to unpack those processes of manipulation and their whole idea that love and abuse were mixed up. That to me is her crisis and her emotional space. So we have to get invited into she can't separate those two men. She can't separate the monster who abused her, and possibly she was one of many, and that's her horror. The other side of that is she was the only one, and this was a great love, and they should have run away together and lived happily ever after. And these two things have become very confused in her. Therefore, to be true to that and to take that really seriously in an uncomfortable way, as is the experience of some survivors, we needed to enter into her emotional space. And that to me is a troubling space to enter, for sure. It never wants to condone what happened, and it's definitely uncomfortable for the audience to relate to him. But for me also, that's another space of literature, dramatic literature and cinema, is that it invites us to also get into the consciousness of people we might otherwise see as monsters in the theatre, like a Richard III or Macbeth are good examples. People we find intolerable. Macbeth is a dictator slaughtering people, but we get into his consciousness while he's making those decisions for a brief moment. We get close to something we wouldn't be able to tolerate. And, you know, it never at any point want to condone what he did. And for me, the important point, and in that final shot, it was part of that, is keeping that damage there. But we do get close to them and uncomfortably close to them as two people who share a bond. And this thing happened to the two of them. If we just said, this is a good guy and this is a victim, we know that the film would lose its power and its pull and its kind of moral complexity.
But so often, and I've talked to filmmakers who have talked about adapting plays, you feel this fealty to the play, that you owe it your loyalty because it exists as this thing that was there before you. And certainly you're trying to find ways to open it up and not make it feel stage-bound and not make it just about two people in a room. Mm-hmm. Because there's just a tension in that when you're sitting in the audience that is hard to recreate in mm-hmm. film. And film is as much as it can be a performance medium. It's also a medium of using all the tools at your disposal. But it sounds like you got the idea pretty quickly that the film had to be his own thing and it didn't have to be loyal to the play.
I would say it is deeply loyal to the core of the play.
I would too.
So I describe it as two children grown from the same DNA. And David Harrower, the writer, was like totally up for that as well. That play will continue to be done in all sorts of languages for many years. I've done a good version of it. David's seen many good versions of it. I don't need to just do that again. It had to become something uniquely cinematic. I can think of a couple of examples in the history of cinema where something feels theatrical from a play, like Gertrude by Dreyer, where you're aware of the theatrical constraints. But plenty of other examples where you kind of may as well have just seen it in the theatre with the actors kind of sweating and breathing and in the same space as you. And yeah, I wanted it to become a piece of pure cinema where, as you say, the performers are part of it, but then so is also the wind in the reeds and the inanimate things. Whereas for me, even on an empty stage, the stage is only empty because the actor just left it. It's all about that body there in front of you. I like to make deep pictures on the stage and visually arresting visceral theatre, but it's all dependent on that actor being there. Now, this film is too, but it's also as much about how the camera floats through empty spaces and landscape and all sorts of things like that. So that was a great invitation to see how could the play open up into other worlds already inside it. And that, for me, is the fidelity to it and to the heart of David's play and to this beautiful, tough invention of that relationship between Una and Ray.
We're out of time. We could talk a lot more about many other things. You've got to come back and do the show again. Are you working on your next film? You're just
yes.
going to be?
Yeah. It's still got the top secret stamp on it, but I hope to be shooting it in this city in the spring.
Oh, my gosh.
So we'll see.
Will it be an original or is it based on another play?
It's not based on a play. It's a true story, but an original screenplay based on that.
Well, I can't wait to see you come back. Benedict, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, Elvis. Thanks a lot.
My guest, again, as combative as he can be, is Benedict Andrews. His first film as director, a recording engineer who also mixes this show, is Kat Yours, edited by Blake Wright, who's associate producer. I have nothing left to say. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com. or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.